Welcome to Conversations with Consequences on EWTN Radio. I'm your host, Mary Fiorito.
And I'm Ashley McGuire.
And we are thrilled to have back with us a close friend and dynamic Catholic leader doing so much within Catholic healthcare, Lewis Brown, who is the executive director of the Christus Medicus Foundation and has also worked for the United States Department of Health and Human Services. Welcome back to the show, Lewis. We're so pleased to have you with us today.
Great to be with you, Mary and Ashley. Thank you so much for having me.
So you have a fairly extensive background in Catholic healthcare, and the HHS is one of the reasons why we really wanted to talk with you this week, Lewis, on several fronts, because just last week, the Supreme Court upheld a trans surgery ban for minors in the state of Tennessee. Can you tell us what you think of the decision and how you reacted to the news?
Yeah, thanks again for having me. Love this show and so grateful. The Scrimeti decision that Chief Justice Roberts offered upholding the constitutionality of Tennessee's state ban on transgender procedures for minors is a big win for kids. It's a big win for families, indirectly a huge win for parental rights, but it's also a win for human dignity. So I'm very pleased and encouraged by the U.S. Supreme Court decision in this case. It will have significant legal impact, but it also will have an impact on the healthcare industry and also cultural impact.
So tell us a little bit more about what its implications are for Catholic healthcare. And maybe tell us, you know, you've been a guest on the show before, but remind our listeners why Christus Medicus Foundation was founded. And, you know, it seems like it's you know, issues like this that have created a real need for alternative human dignity affirming insurance options.
Sure, 100%. So what happened over the last couple of years is that I think what we saw was a rise of gender ideology in the United States, an ideology which is fundamentally flawed. It gets the anthropology of the human person wrong. And that gender ideology was weaponized to coerce medical professionals, to coerce healthcare institutions, to coerce state and federal government, and to even coerce children and families to perform procedures that we now know are medically, physically, and emotionally, and even psychologically harmful to children, to families, and violate the dignity of the human person. Mm-hmm. So that's what's happened over the years. Things got so challenging, both in Western Europe and in the United States, I would say up until about four years ago, that people were afraid to speak out against gender ideology. We saw, by way of example, the backlash against J.K. Rowling, the British author, who spoke out against gender ideology and for the dignity of women. Now, I'm not a huge fan of the Harry Potter books. I have my reasons. I much prefer J.R.R. Tolkien and Lord of the Rings, which is very different. But that shows you just the level of really a culture, a kind of a cancel culture, if you spoke out against gender ideology. And then what started, some of the backdrop of the Supreme Court decision, we started to see the New York Times about a year and a half ago, 2 years ago, started to truthfully report about the real medical concerns about transgender procedures. Then we saw the CAS review, the United Kingdom government's commissioned comprehensive medical review of transgender procedures on young people, and particularly children in the United Kingdom, that was led by Dr. Hilary Cass. And then we saw a wave of states, Ashley and Mary, that decided to significantly restrict or just outright ban at least certain transgender procedures, particularly for minors. And when Tennessee passed its law prohibiting these unethical, harmful procedures for minors, a constitutional challenge was brought to the Tennessee law to say that Tennessee law violates the Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment of the U.S. Constitution. And the U.S. Supreme Court said no. The Tennessee's ban on transgender procedures for minors does not violate the Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment. And in fact, the state of Tennessee, and by implication, other states, have constitutionally permissible reasons for prohibiting transgender procedures, including their serious concerns about the health and safety of children. So again, a huge win for states, a huge win for families. The Supreme Court has said in this committee decision definitively that it is constitutionally permissible for state legislatures to ban these procedures that are harmful for children and families, particularly for children that are dealing with gender incongruence or gender confusion. And so I could go on, but I'll stop there. Massive implications for the country, massive implications culturally. Just the fact that we have a US Supreme Court decision that says that there are legitimate medical reasons to question so-called gender-affirming care. What we see everywhere, the mainstream media still says, largely, with some exceptions, that it's all about animosity, that it's all about some type of bigotry or some type of hostility towards people that are struggling with gender incongruence, gender confusion. In reality, it's the exact opposite. The true What the Supreme Court decision implies and what the evidence suggests is that those medical professionals, those bioethicists, those state legislators and policymakers that are restricting so-called gender-affirming care, these transgender procedures, these are the leaders, the policymakers, the medical professionals that have real care and concern, and that are seeking to protect children and provide them true, dignified, healing care.
You know, Lewis, what's so interesting to me, just as a mother of teenagers, is that when I look at like the insurance rates for the car insurance rates example for my teenagers as opposed to my children who are a little bit older, the tables that they use to calculate these things, right? They all understand statistically that the human brain doesn't fully develop until it's about 24 or 25 years old. It's a little bit later in males than it is in females, but yet the frontal cortex part of decision making isn't really fully there, which is why you have criminal justice attorneys and people in the criminal justice space very strongly advocating for things like reduced sentencing for people who commit crimes when they are below the age of 24 or 25, as opposed to people who have fully formed adult brains. Yet when we're in the talking about the space of, you know, gender transitions or even, for example, you know, minors making decisions about having abortions, we're told to trust teenagers. Well, you know, I find a very, just as a lawyer myself and as a mother of teenagers, I have a lot of difficulty, you know, squaring those two things. Did you find any of that particular argument, like for example, what's being done in the criminal justice space, helpful when arguing against the other?
Yeah, I think so. I think so. And I would say this in this context. I've said this in other venues, Mary and Ashley. The tragedy here of gender ideology, particularly in healthcare, is twofold. The first is that these transgender procedures, ranging from puberty blockers to cross-sex hormones and also social transitioning, do severe damage to mental, emotional, psychological health. The Chief Justice even remarked on the Tennessee legislature's concern that these transgender procedures were causing children to be disdainful, quote unquote, disdainful of their sex, meaning that the gender ideology and transgender procedures has caused children to have a contempt for their own body and for their own beauty and goodness, which is tragic. So that's the first tragedy here. And I think that the Supreme Court showed courage and a commitment to the truth about the reality here. The decision wasn't perfect, but it was a huge step in the right direction. But the second tragedy, which also speaks to an opportunity, is even more serious. The tragedy, particularly for Catholic healthcare and for medical professionals that are committed to the truth, is that gender ideology and these transgender procedures that go with them has hidden, has disguised, has almost stolen from children true medical, psychological, and pastoral pathways to to healing, to resolution, to an acceptance of the reality of every child's goodness and dignity. What I've attempted to point to Catholic leaders, to bishops, to families as well, is as an example of the great care and healing and resolution that can be possible is the work of Dr. Bob Schutz and his book, Be Restored. Dr. Bob Schutz is a Catholic psychologist who's based in Tallahassee, Florida. He leads the John Paul II Healing Center. And I've only read the first half of the book. I haven't read the second half, but Be Restored is a magnum opus of the Christ-centered Catholic healthcare approach to caring for children and really adults, anyone who's particularly struggling with sexual insecurity and issues of their sexuality. And that is so much more powerful and effective and beautiful and healing than what bankrupt gender ideology has to offer. So to me, that's kind of the second tragedy, but it's also an opportunity. It's an opportunity to provide great, efficacious, medically based care for our kids, for our families, for our friends and communities, and to show real love for our brothers and sisters.
Lewis, you mentioned the coercive side of gender ideology, and we've certainly seen in a lot of different spaces, not just healthcare, education, a real attempt to conscript people into it. And you could say the same thing about abortion, and it just seems like they never tire of trying to force healthcare workers, the other side, the abortion lobby, into healthcare workers, insurance companies, you name it, doctors, into this. Where do you see things now when it comes to that? We just celebrated the third anniversary of the Dobbs decision, which returns the issue back to the states. What's your take on the post-Dobbs landscape at year three?
Sure, thanks. And I great question. So I am very sober
That's a good
and
word.
seriously concerned about the challenges that the pro-life movement faced and convicted about the extraordinary opportunity to take back healthcare and to take back our country for the culture of life. I really am. By way of example, I was privileged to watch a podcast on defunding Planned Parenthood yesterday, and enjoyed some of the remarks from Chloe Clow, who's a person who's detransitioned and who's courageously spoken out. And I was interested by the fact that the now famous NCAA athlete Riley Gaines was also on that podcast, who's primarily spoken out in favor of women's dignity and women's rights in sports. I had not heard her speak about the pro-life issue. What I think we're seeing is a revival and a concern and a commitment to the truth within American society, and a confluence of factors that is bringing opposition to gender ideology, and opposition to the dehumanization of unborn children and women together, and a new movement for a culture of life, what I'm hoping for, a leonine revolution, in which we restore human dignity and the goodness and beauty of the human body and the human person from conception to natural death in healthcare. That's what I think we have an opportunity. We have this unique political window, 3.5 years, where we have a federal executive branch, an HHS department, the Trump administration, and Congress that is at least, say what you will, but at least supportive of the truth, the anthropological truth of the human person, and that believes in the centrality of human dignity to the American project. I'm hopeful that it'll be not just 3.5 years, but another 8 years, perhaps, of general support at the federal level, legal support for the dignity of the human person and for a true anthropology of who we are as human beings. That gives space for the pro-life movement to divest out of pro-abortion care and create a pro-life healthcare ecosystem in the United States to bring people, what I like to say, particularly in Catholic circles, to bring our country, to bring patients and mothers and children and the disabled into the womb of the Blessed Mother, into a pro-life healthcare ecosystem where children and persons with disabilities and families are safe, protected, cared for, loved, and secure. And so that's the opportunity that we have, and I'm hopeful about that. But the challenge is the rising culture of death continues. It's not just abortion. It's not just gender
Mm-hmm.
ideology. It's all types of passive and active euthanasia. We just saw New York State legalize assisted suicide. These are serious challenges. But I think that after some initial setbacks, we have been chastened. And I think that the pro-life movement is coming out stronger and more collaborative and more strategic than we have been in a while.
You know, Lewis, I'm in Chicago, where the Pope is from, in case you had not heard that. The Pope is a Chicagoan. I mentioned this on every podcast now. I work in it in some way or shape or form. But we just yesterday morning buried Sister Rosemary Connolly, who was a religious sister of mercy, who for almost 60 years ran Misericordia, Latin for Heart of Mercy. She was a pioneer in treating people with Down syndrome and also adults with developed mental disabilities, many of whom now society would say, really, just why would you have them live this life of suffering? They should just be aborted, right? So, Pope Leo sent a beautiful letter for her funeral mass yesterday morning, saying that, you know, well, of course he would have known her because, you know, she was just a Chicago legend. And there was one of the funnier clips I saw on the news about her death was Rahm Emanuel recounting when he was trying to charge nonprofits, including Misericordia. So all of these hundreds of people with developmental disabilities living there, he was going to charge them for public water. And she grabbed him by the arm at an event and said, "Rahm, God is watching you." And he started to cry. I mean, it was just, but when you
Wow,
have
that's
somebody,
something.
but she always said it was so beautiful, you know, and this was recounted, at the eulogy for her funeral. She saw Christ in every human person, and but also said, you know, the Lord was always so good to put the right people in front of her at the right time because he wanted those people cared for. And when we talk about assisted suicide, Lewis, your remarks make me think of a doctor friend who has almost exclusively cares for people with Down syndrome. And she said, my older people are terrified of assisted suicide, but she said, my parents are even more terrified because of the way in which insurance does not cover even things that we would consider very, very much normal care for them, right? Can you speak a little bit about the threat to the disabled community by
In
these
thousand
assisted
percent,
suicide? Yeah.
100%. So two 3 points real quick. So first, I'm 43, was born in 1981. And thanks be to God, I was blessed to encounter children with Down syndrome everywhere. It was normal. Brothers and sisters of classmates.
Right, of course. Very much woven into the fabric of
100%.
society, right?
I'm originally from the Detroit area. I had at least one colleague. My first job was a wonderful job at a movie theater in Oakland County, and at least one of my colleagues, and probably two or three, had Down syndrome. It was great. It's 20, decades later, I never see people with Down syndrome. It's tragic because so many of them have been aborted. It is absolutely tragic. So two additional points. That's just a vignette. 2 points. Number one, it is vital that we as the pro-life movement, that we stretch and expand the moral imagination of what the pro-life movement is called to be by St. John Paul II and by the Holy Spirit. It starts with protecting the unborn with maximum determination, but it extends to the entire expanse of the person, of human dignity, of our fellow brothers and sisters in the United States, particularly in healthcare. As you all know, I'm an attorney, and I was blessed to serve and when I was at HHS as a political appointee, served at the HHS Office for Civil Rights, and oversaw the Civil Rights Division for my great boss, Roger Severino. And I was concerned about many issues. We worked on numerous civil rights issues to ensure that we were really enforcing civil rights to protect patients from unjust discrimination. Amongst the most egregious discrimination that I saw while I was at HHS was discrimination against persons with disabilities or that had become incapacitated. It was almost as though within aspects of the healthcare system that discrimination against folks with disabilities was okay, was permissible. We saw this most, I would say, most astutely, most concretely during COVID, where you had at least one or two state governments and some healthcare entities that put persons with disabilities at the back of the line for care in the early days of the COVID public health crisis. And so we live in a world where we have a rising throwaway culture of death in the healthcare system, where I think largely unwittingly, some healthcare systems, some medical professionals are unjustly denying persons with disabilities care. In some cases, and particularly in hospice settings, they're depriving patients who might be dying unjustly of the basic ordinary means of care, food and water. We have health insurance plans that are using quality of life determinations to also further effectively deny care to persons with disabilities. It is a serious issue. The unjust discrimination towards persons with disabilities is a serious issue within our healthcare system, and it's a vital issue for the pro-life movement in America.
Your mentioning of Down syndrome, I was the same way, grew up feeling like they were just another normal part of life. And fast forward to when I got the call on my, speakerphone on my car from the doctor's office, going through some of the genetic testing that they'd done or whatever, just part of the routine blood draw. The nurse said something, know this, know that, know Down syndrome. And the call ended, and my daughter said, "What's Down syndrome?" And I just remember being horrified that, we live in a world where such an ableist society. You mentioned your time serving in HHS. Looking at this administration, we have a lot of opportunities to impact the healthcare system for good. What do you see as someone working in this space as what would you say should be the top priorities for this Department of Health and Human Services?
Sure. I on HHS, the first several weeks of being choosing my words carefully, I was amazed by the good work that the current White House and the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services did on the top issues involving the culture of life. So, right away, we saw the Trump administration issue an incredible executive order repudiating gender ideology and affirming the anthropological truth of the human person that we have two sexes, male and female, that the human implicitly that the human body is good, and testifying to the reality that the balance of medical care in the United States is based on the binary reality of two biological sexes in society and civilization. So that was great. We also saw executive action affirming the Hyde Amendment that restricts public funding of abortion and dedicating the administration to fully enforcing the Hyde Amendment, ensuring that our tax dollars aren't going to fund the intentional killing of unborn children in America. We've also seen a real commitment by the HHS Secretary Kennedy and the HHS Office of Civil Rights, which is led by a phenomenal lawyer, Paula Stannard. She's amazing. I worked with her in the prior administration. We've seen that the HHS Office of Civil Rights in this administration has a real commitment to medical conscience rights and to stopping abortion coercion and to stopping the coercion of medical professionals on issues of gender ideology. So it's a new day. We have an existing presidential administration that's seemingly committed to the culture of life, that's committed to no taxpayer funding for abortion, that's committed to enforcing medical conscience rights, and is committed to the truth of the human person, particularly as regards to human anthropology, the anthropology of the person, and its implications for the healthcare industry. Those things are great. The top issues, so I'm very hopeful and encouraged by all of those actions. My message for HHS and for Congress is to really focus on a few issues. I'll just put a couple out there. Number one, the most fundamental issue is the right to life. And so the importance of defunding Planned Parenthood in Congress and defunding any abortion providers that may be receiving federal funding, that's number one. Number two is robust enforcement of medical conscience rights through investigations and compliance reviews and great educational guidance so that healthcare entities are fully enforcing and applying the federal medical conscience laws that essentially say all healthcare entities in the United States that receive federal financial assistance must respect and protect the medical conscience rights of their healthcare professionals. That's vital. So that pr number one is defunding Planned Parenthood and no taxpayer funding for abortion. Number two is ensuring full enforcement of medical conscience rights and also looking to Congress to pass the Conscience Protection Act that would allow medical professionals to sue in federal court should their conscience or religious liberty rights be violated.
Well, Lewis, thank you so much for giving us so much of your time today. To learn more about Lewis Brown and the Christus Medicus Foundation, please visit christusmedicus.org. To learn more about us at the Catholic Association, please just go to thecatholicassociation.org to follow everything we do in radio, TV, print, and online and in our local communities. Lewis Brown, thank you again for being with us today.
Such a pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Welcome back to Conversations with Consequences. I'm your hostess, Betsy Fentress, and we are thrilled to welcome Professor Michael Hurley on the show today. He's a professor of literature and theology and a fellow and director of studies at Trinity College within the University of Cambridge. He's the author of countless books, including Poetic Form and Faith in Poetry, and he's also the co-editor of the Hopkins Quarterly, a journal on the works of Gerard Manley Hopkins and his circle. And just this year, he released a new book on angels, Angels and Monotheism. Welcome back to the show, Michael.
Thank you so much. It's lovely to be back.
There is a lot to cover here because I think everybody, at least in our readership and listenership, loves angels. But you're taking a little bit more of an academic look at them, but also from a faith perspective. So I wanted to begin you, the beginning of the book, you say, the world was once aflush with angels until they became irrelevant, if not embarrassing, and were almost completely exiled by the twin forces of secularism and scientism. Almost, but not quite. So are you advocating for the not quite of that phrase?
Very much so, yes. So it's important, I think, that you've mentioned that the book I've written is quite an academic book because the people I have in the crosshairs are largely academics who talk about angels. I think that angels have an afterlife still in religious devotion for many people, but somehow they've become embarrassing in the sense of not intellectually respectable to talk about. And this wasn't the case for the vast majority of human history across all major faith traditions, including Christianity. So it's a very significant turn insofar as not just venerating angels, but thinking very hard about what it means that angels exist in the world was very important to Christianity, but also to Judaism and Islam and many other religions too. And we've sort of boxed ourselves into an odd place where to talk about them now seems like it's somehow not very respectable or somehow unscientific. And so my book is really thinking about what the fallout of that is, why that's a big mistake. And one could say, well, who cares what academics talk about? They have their own little conversations in their ivory towers and so on. But I think that the academic world and their conversation about angels, their non-conversation about angels, reflects on the one hand, but also encourages, on the other hand, us not to take them seriously in a way that I think is a real problem for those of us who have a religious faith.
So your impetus for taking angels as something to defend came out of, did it, is there any personal backstory to this?
Well, only that I spoke to, I had many conversations with my late mother about angels, and especially towards the end of her life. In fact, we were talking about what was to come, and it was a very moving and personal time. And we spoke about angels not in an academic context, but in the context that they were real. And it occurred to me that the vast majority of writing that is on angels now in an academic context presumes they're not real, presumes they're a kind of human projection of a certain sort. So let's say when in the 19th century, with industrialization or a sense that the world is closing in, that angels become sort of divine super soothers that we project into the world, like a like Freud would say that somehow religions are a kind of fantasy. And this isn't wasn't my mother's faith. It's not my own faith. It's not the faith of the vast majority of Catholics and Christians that I know. And so I began to think seriously about why this might be the case. And it seems to me that angels are a little bit like canaries in the coal mine, that they when they die or when they're culled or when they somehow can't thrive, that we have a very big problem coming down the track. Or as I was explaining this to my children, who were saying, "Why are you writing this book about angels, Daddy?" And I said, "You know the game Jenga, you know, where you have to pull out the blocks,
Right.
you can't let the tower fall down." I think some modern theologians think that if they pull out the embarrassing bits, which is the supernatural bits, that somehow the tower will be more robust, it will stand up more fully. Whereas my argument is this is the opposite of what's true, that in fact, thinking about angels and the people who've thought about angels, Saint Augustine or Saint Aquinas or Pseudo Dionysius, all the great thinkers, understand that angels aren't just an optional part, but they're a way of understanding the whole. And so I wanted to write a book which really reminded people of that. So it has a little bit of a polemical character.
Can you walk us through the three religions of Christianity, Judaism, Islam, and their relationship to angels?
Yeah, sure. Well, it's important that we think about those three, and part of the emphasis on my book is thinking about those three because angels are really in every religion through all time. All documented religions, Zoroastrianism, you can see them in, you know, in Egyptian religions and so on. But with monotheism, with a religion that thinks there's one God, then angels become potentially a bit of a problem. And people who are hostile to religion, who are historians of religion, what they say is, you know, what monotheism is really is a kind of disguised polytheism, so that all these other gods haven't really gone away. We've just shuffled them off into this category called angels. And the people who say that, and that's a significant body of historians, religions who say that, people who say that imagine that somehow having angels is really an implicit threat to God, an implicit threat because, hold on, if these angels are really other kinds of deities, then who's to say that the God that you worship is the real God, or who's to say that there is one supreme being in the first place? And so in the context of something like Judaism, it's true that if you look at early Judaism, it looks like henotheism, which is to say there's one God that we should worship, but there are other gods, but there's one that we should worship. And it's only over time that this develops into an idea. No, there's actually only one God. And there's a similar kind of trajectory you can see in early Christianity. When Islam comes along, it says, you know, look, Christianity and Judaism, these are really disguised polytheistic religions. And so we're really going to be monotheistic. So we're not going to have the Trinity. We're not going to have the saints. We're not going to have all these things which look like they're corrupting the idea of a one God. But the problem is that Islam, the Quran is dictated by the angel Gabriel. So, you know, all the three of the religions are in this interesting position of thinking, okay, angels are divinely created beings. They're real beings, but what is their status? And thinking about their status in relation to humans, in relation to God, is the work of so-called angelology, people who study angels. And one way of thinking about this is if you think about modern anthropologists, they often like to think, okay, let's try and understand how humans behave by looking at something else. Let's look at chimps. Let's look at apes, how they behave. And if you look at, let's say, a mating ritual or power displays or just how they operate in a community, maybe we can understand something a little bit about humans. And people who studied angels over the, you know, the many centuries going all the way back more than 2000 years had a similar kind of interest. It was saying, okay, if angels are like humans, but not human, and they're like God, but not God, then they can help us understand what it is to be human, but they can also help us understand what it is to be God. Because God, by definition, resists human capacity. So angels play this very important part in all of these three monotheistic religions as a way of understanding what it is to be human and understanding what it is to be God. But they also present this potential problem because you think, well, if you don't venerate them but worship them, then, of course, you get idolatry. You get them being treated as gods as opposed to being angels.
This is sort of the whole Protestant Catholic Virgin Mary question, right?
Absolutely. Yeah.
Just reworked about angels.
Yes. Very well said. Yeah.
So I was recently at the Uffizi Gallery and I was just thinking about your book and how angels are everywhere in medieval art. I mean, they're just, it's almost an obsession with Fra Angelico to make sure that, I mean, so beautifully rendered. And let's talk a little bit about why the angels had their sort of special place in the medieval world that we can't seem to recover.
Yeah. It's a great question, because the medieval world is absolutely the high point of veneration and study of angels. It's true. Well, there've been lots of trying to account for where we are now in our modernity as against where we were in the medieval period. Mm-hmm. And perhaps the most important book that was written, big book, called A Secular Age by Charles Taylor.
Oh, yeah,
and,
I read that.
And so if you know that book, one of the things he says is he takes up Weber's idea of disenchantment, that we lived in an enchanted world. So the physical world was shot through with the spiritual world. And in our lives, we experienced what in superstitious terms you might call magic, and in religious terms you'd call the supernatural. And so there wasn't this physical realm, and maybe there's this very detached other realm, but rather the physical and the metaphysical, the spiritual and material are intermingling. If you think what an angel is, in the Greek word angel, angelos, means messenger. So what it means is that God is present amongst you. It's not a God of deism, a God who's far removed, who you could speculate about, he's like a kind of divine watchmaker who's made the world and he's just stepped back from it, but rather that God is in the world, operating within the world and shaping the world, shaping the moral character of the world. And so the medieval period was profoundly alive to the idea that the physical and the spiritual were in a kind of dance, in a kind of play. Mm-hmm. And angels are the obvious symbol of that because they represent God on earth. They are God's messengers. And it's important to say that because although angels are individual entities, ontologies, beings, they are defined by what they do, not what they are. And what they do is prosecute the will of God, the love of God. They are the messengers of God. And so the medieval period is a period in touch with God, you might say, in the way that our own period, for various reasons, has created a buffer between our material existence and the idea of a spiritual existence, which is all the way up in heaven somewhere, but doesn't really operate on earth.
Sure. Let's talk about how, with the advent of science and the progress of science, they don't seem to be compatible anymore. And I'm particularly interested in a little piece that you sent me, that angelology was rocket fuel for the birth of modern science. So in other words, our belief in angels and things we cannot see is actually a really important part of science. And yet science wants to dismiss angels for that very reason. Isn't it a paradox?
Yes, it's a real paradox. And there's a history of Western civilization which goes something like this. We were superstitious, we believed in magic, and then we were a little bit less credulous, we believed in religion, and then when we've really grown up and we're mature, we believe in science, and then we put all that other stuff away. So someone like Steven Pinker has a book called Enlightenment Now, where he presses this narrative, and he wants us all to grow up, essentially. But his account of this development, this three-stage development from magic and superstition into religion, into science, is an idea of science which never really existed. It's an idea that Isaac Newton of a clockwork certainty. Now, Isaac Newton himself was an alchemist. He was very interested in angels himself. I mean, in my own college in Cambridge, Isaac Newton is an alumnus. He was here, and you can go to his rooms and you can
Trinity
see where
College, yeah.
he was, you know, engaged in alchemy. But so also the man thought to be the greatest mathematician in England at the time, someone called John Dee, Dr. Dee, and he documents 133 conversations he has with angels. So there never was this time,
really.
Yeah. And so there never was this time of clockwork certainty. And insofar as it was ushered in by Newton and others in terms of let's have proof, let's have evidence and so on, that was a phase that is now long gone. I mean, we have quantum, we have chaos theory, we have black holes. We're back into a world again, which is very strange and uncertain and undecided. And so this idea that somehow science was opposed or is opposed to things we might think of as supernatural is not true. The other thing to say is that the so-called scientific revolution was meant to have happened in the 16th and 17th centuries, but actually in the 13th century, if we go back to the medieval period that we were talking about, the high point of angelology, there's a very important moment in 1277 when a bishop of Paris has a whole series of declarations which is trying to assert the primacy of religion over science in a particularly narrow way, so over Aristotle's idea of science. So he overrides and says, no, God can do anything, including things that appear to be contradictory. And this opens up huge thought experiments around angels, like can they travel at, you know, at infinite speed, and can they do this and can they do that? And it looks a lot like stuff that Einstein and others are saying about photons into the 20th century. So what this does, the reason I mention this historically, is that rather than science coming out of dismissing religion, the rocket fuel I mentioned is that what happens is that this interest in angels legitimizes, makes possible thought experiments, which are really the heart of science. Because what is science other than it tests its experiments, but it's about theorizing, speculating, opening the mind. And if you say, look, God can literally do anything and his angels are a way of thinking about that, then what you happen is this explosion of intellectual energy. And that really is the untold story of the birth of science.
And how does Thomas Aquinas fit into all of this?
Well, Aquinas is someone who thinks very deeply, obviously, about angels. And he's associated with scholasticism, which the negative account of which is a highly intellectualized, highly logical position and so on. But remember about Aquinas, when he's written a million plus words of his great tome, you know, his Summa Theologica, and he has this experience of God, and he says, this is all hay, this is all straw and so on. So he believes very profoundly in the intellectual enterprise, but doesn't think that we can grasp everything. And so faith is the important feeder of that. And so he will say things like, you know, in trying to understand angels, and we think, well, what do they look like? What's their form? Can they fly? Do they have wings? He will say things like, well, they only have bodies for our sake, not for theirs. So we can sort of understand them. We can mediate them in a particular way. So on the one hand, he talks profoundly about angels and how important they are within a big cosmology. If you want to understand all of creation, you have to understand the angels within it. But he also says that the human understanding of angels you have to be checked by a sense in which we are finite, fallible beings fumbling along trying to understand them. So there's a real humility built into that. That's the opposite of what you see in someone like Steven Pinker, which is hubris, a sense in which the human mind and intellect can know all things, and that which it can't prove in a laboratory is fantasy of some sort. Aquinas is taking the very opposite position.
So how important in 2025 are angels to our daily practice of the faith?
Well, it's very interesting because I've spoke about disenchantment before and how you can think, well, people are becoming less religious. This is often said. I don't think this is true. I think many people are disaffiliating. That is to say, they're not being part of official religious practices. But I think the hunger and the yearning for the spiritual is very, very strong. And you see this directed in all kinds of interesting ways, some dark ways, things like Wicca, you know, witchcraft and so on, some kind of weirdly secular ways like Soul Cycle or Harry Potter fandom or this sort of stuff. So the appetite is really there. And I think that when we think about the importance of angels in this context, I think it does two things. One is that it reminds us that the physical world is in fact alive with the spiritual world. So I think that focusing on angels can bring God closer in a way, because God otherwise, who's defined by being indefinable to human terms, can feel very detached, I think. But if you think that there's an angelic order, and certainly within the Catholic tradition, if you think about guardian angels, for example, there's a real intimacy. It brings God very close. And so it bridges that gap. And so I think it allows your faith, on the one hand, to feel legitimized, that you can believe in things which you can't prove, as Aquinas would say, but also it can feel personal and intimate and not a purely intellectual enterprise, that you can feel that you're being guided in ways that, you know, historically have always been understood and only comparatively recently thought to be somewhat embarrassing.
And, you know, we just celebrated the feast of John the Baptist, and there's so much of that story relies on angels.
And
of course, the Magnificat, Mary's Fiat. I mean, that's all predicated on believing that God can send these messengers.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. I mean, it's interesting because in all of the major religions are anxious about taking this seriously. So even something like Islam, which, you know, as they say, the angel Gabriel is, they take the... Islam takes the angel Gabriel to be the angel that dictates the Quran. Even there, you see modern Islamic scholars saying, oh, but angels aren't divine postmen. You know, let's remember this is a psychological phenomenon. This is just something in your head and so on. And so I think it's interesting. It's an interesting problem for Christianity in particular, but it's part of a bigger problem, which is what we want to do in the modern world is somehow to make angels into metaphors or symbols or psychological projections, as opposed to thinking, no, God is speaking to me. And all the examples you give of God speaking through his angels to us, and we need to listen. It's not just an intellectual exercise, and it's not just our internal voices.
Well, that is a great place for us to end. And I am so grateful that you are defending angels in the academic world.
Doing what I can.
Again, your book is?
Angels and Monotheism.
And where can our listeners get that?
Well, it's Cambridge University Press. You can get it. It's a short book. And I should warn you, it's somewhat insider baseball. It's me trying to really go for the theologians who I see as are the big problem. But yes, I'm trying to fight the good fight in my little area. And I hope very much I might write another kind of book about angels, which is more hospitable to people who don't need to be bashed over the head with their reality, but in fact, just want to know more about them.
Well, I hope you do that. To learn more about Michael Hurley and his books, please visit the University of Cambridge website. And to make sure to follow us and all the great work we do at the Catholic Organization, including our new Substack, at CatholicAssociation.org. and CatholicAssociation.substack.
Welcome back to Conversations with Consequences here on EWTN Radio. I'm joined by our wonderful TCA chaplain, Monsignor Roger Landry. And today we're talking about an article that he has coming out in the National Catholic Register and commemorating the 50th anniversary of the death of St. Jose Maria Escrivá, the founder of Opus Dei. Welcome to the show, Monsignor.
Great to be with you, Ashley. Yeah, Thursday, June 26th this year is the 50th anniversary of not just the death, but for those of us who are Catholic, the birth into eternal life of somebody who St. John Paul II canonized in 2002, St. Jose Maria Escrivá. He's most famous, of course, for founding Opus Dei in 1928, but he was a person who was an extraordinary retreat master for priests when he was still in Spain. He's somebody who John Paul II called the Apostle of Ordinary Life, whom many others have called the Apostle of the Laity, because he was the one, more than anybody else, who took the what we now take for granted as the universal call to holiness and made it universal. Prior to his work in, you know, beginning in 1928 and in the first half of last century, promoting that everyone by baptism is called to be a saint, that was a controversial, and some even thought it was a heretical idea. Jesus made us in, you know, God made us in his image and likeness, and we know he's holy, holy, holy. So the vocation to holiness goes as far back as the first book of the Bible. God told us through Moses, be holy, for I, the Lord your God, am holy. Jesus called us to be perfect as he is, the Father is perfect, and to love as he has loved us. These are all sort of recipes for holiness. But the church said, at a practical level, that if you were going to become a saint, you had to be normally a religious. Not even diocesan priests were really called to the high standard of holiness, that it were religious men and women who were asked to get A pluses on the gift of life, but the rest of us were on a pass-fail track and kind of like a second-class series of expectations. And so Saint Jose Maria revolutionized all of that, and his work was so fruitful that in the Second Vatican Council, its main teaching on the universal call to holiness has become so widespread that more or less all of us take it for granted at an intellectual level that we're called to be saints, even if at a practical level, many of us, myself first in line, don't do everything that's necessary in order to be the saints that God wills. But we owe Saint Jose Maria so much. And as we mark his 50th anniversary, we thank God for the gift of Saint Jose Maria to the church. And we thank Saint Jose Maria for working so hard against so many obstacles to help 100 out of 100, including the 98 out of 100 who happen to be lay people, recognize that we're all called to be like God, holy as he is holy.
And I found I'm not in Opus Dei, but I follow his that the their charism, if you will, and I find it so helpful, especially as a mom, that you can find holiness in these ordinary moments, like doing the dishes, bathing your children, moments that seem frustrating are opportunities to grow in holiness. And talking about the plan of life, you've written a book about the plan of life. What are some of the tenets or the practices that define this legacy that he's left behind?
So it's good that she used that phrase, plan of life. I learned it from members of Opus Dei, whom I had never heard of before I got to college, who made the pursuit of holiness practical for me when I was at university. It tries to unite all the moments of the day to God. So it's a game plan that helps us to remember that God is with us and that we're trying to do everything we're doing in communion with Him. So it starts as soon as you get out of bed by a morning offering, by an act of consciousness that I'm going to try to give the day to you, God. It finishes with a general examination of conscience at the end of the day, in which you review how God was with you throughout the day and finish with three words. Thank you, Lord, for all that you give me today. Sorry for the times that I haven't fully cooperated with what you're doing, and help me more tomorrow. And everything in between, from some time of prayer, daily mass if we can, the Angelus or the Regina Caeli at midday, little acts of the presence of God throughout the day, thanksgiving and sorrow if something is going wrong in the world or in our life that the Lord would be somehow offended. We're trying to unite the entire day to God. And Saint Jose Maria was a genius in giving a bunch of practices that would help ordinary people offer their work to God, whatever their work be, from professor to garbage collector to literally everybody in every profession, to try to offer it to God as the sacrifice of Abel. That's work that's been made holy, knowing that when we do holy work, God tries to perfect us so that we can become holy through the virtues of work well done. And he also puts us in places sometimes through our work that we can really love others. We can be their friends in the workplace or in the school. We can offer the work that we've done well. Let's just say somebody's a surgeon or a nurse, by caring for somebody to be able to get better. I mean, all of these things are meant to flow from and lead to our communion with God, who is holy, holy, holy. And Saint Jose Maria was the one who brought that message and made it practical to the world. And how successful his life was, that now pretty much everybody everywhere in the church knows about the universal call to holiness, even if they might never have heard of the type of role that Saint Jose Maria played in making that such a common horizon.
Well, we thank you, Monsignor, for reflecting on this wonderful saint with us and for the reminder that all of us are called to holiness even in those ordinary moments. So thank you, Monsignor.
You're welcome. Let's just say Saint Jose Maria on your 50th anniversary. Pray for us.
Amen.
God bless you, Ashley.
Thank you.